So this is our last shiur about Purim. So we've made it through a lot of ideas about Purim. And just a brief shiur, I know it's Erev Shabbos and everyone is shiur today, so we'll speak very, very briefly today. One of the oddities of the Megillah is that they chose the same day. Remember, the letters which empowered the Jews to defend themselves were written in Sivan. And everyone knows that in a military battle, the best strategy is the surprising your enemy, is the ability to attack them when they don't anticipate it. This past week there was a very successful Israeli operation in one of the hospitals in Gaza, the Shifa Hospital. What had happened? A couple of weeks ago, the Israeli army encircled this hospital, but everyone spoke about it. So for days, everyone knew that Israel was entering the hospital. So all the terrorists, Yimach Shemam, ran away. So they came into the hospital, there's no one to capture, or very few people to capture. Whereas this past week, the Israeli army entered the Shifa hospital in a surprise attack. No one knew. And they caught close to 700 mechablim, or 600 mechablim, and about another, I think, 50 to 100 were killed, and they arrested about 600. So you always want to have the sense of surprise. And here it's Sivan, and you're still several months away from Adar. So if I'm Mordechai and Esther, I'll say, you know what? Let's surprise our enemies. They're getting ready for the 13th. They have all their weapons prepared. They have all their bombs set to go off on Adar the 13th. Let's pick a random date in the summer that we can surprise attack them. And we'll attack them, I don't know, Tesvav Av or Yud Zayin Av before they get a chance. So we'll catch them in a surprise attack, as unfortunately we saw our own people were caught in a surprise attack. So why are Mordechai and Esther are trying to devise or design the counterattack? Why do they pick the same day? The answer is, of course, is because the whole Megillah, the one word that probably best characterizes the Megillah, and we sing the word is V'nahafachu. The exact same day, Ashasibru Hayud, Ashasibru, that they wanted to attack us, we defeated them. Why is that important? It has poetic license, but why is V'nahafachu so important? Okay, the answer is as follows, and then I'll give you a couple other examples. Purim is our second galus. Our first galus is Mitzrayim. Everything in Jewish history is cyclical, which means everything is overlapping, which means everything that happens in one galus is a paradigm for other galuses, just like everything that happens in one gula. We don't believe that history is linear and evolutionary. Everything is cyclical. So in Purim and in Shushan, there are patterns of galus that are being built, patterns of galus that we can learn from. And I spoke about this the other day. And we participate in government, we improve the government, we get close to the royal crown, we're a people that are in favor of stability and organization and authority, institutionalism. We're not destabilizing forces in the countries that host us, as Haman suggested that we were when he tried to twist the truth. But there are also some metaphysical truths that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was setting into place in Shushan that will continue to recycle throughout history. And that metaphysical truth about Golos is, remember, this is a whole new age of anti-Semitism. You could make the claim that the first anti-Semite was Haman. Namely, all of the kingdoms that attacked us in Bayis Rishon, you could all excuse that as geopolitical. We were in Eretz Yisrael, we had a monarchy, Ammon had a monarchy, Moab had a monarchy, the Plishtim had their chieftains. So just like Ammon and Moab went to war with Midian, or just like Midian went to war with Assyria, just like Assyria went to war with Egypt, similarly, we went to war. So they may not have been seething hatred of the Jewish people. Paro could have been the first anti-Semite. Lavan, Chazal speak about. But this is the first time that you see the anti-Semitism that we know. Let's commit genocide. Let's eliminate the entire people, lock, stock, and barrel, men, women, and children. In fact, as I mentioned to you yesterday, we don't really have the content of Haman's letter. We don't really know what the letter said. But in the Targum and in the Medrash, we actually have the content. I'm not going to read you the letter, but if you were to read Haman's letter, it would sound like it was stripped right out of the headlines in today's news. Literally the exact same claims that are being made against the people of Israel and the state of Israel today were made by Haman. Twisting the truth, the victim is blamed for retaliating. We're the victim here, but the victim is blamed for retaliating. We're committing genocide. We're taking other people's money. It's literally the same. So this is the beginning of rabid anti-Semitism. And Hashem creates a mechanism, a device, an engine within history where the more that anti-Semites try to attack us and annihilate us, they themselves are the engine for future Jewish growth. It's not just that Hashem defeats them. Hashem defeated Paro. Hashem defeated Sisera. Hashem defeated all of our previous enemies. But here, in the story of Purim, repeatedly, everything that Haman does boomerangs. And either boomerangs to his own demise, or boomerangs to spur the growth of Jewish history and of Jewish peoplehood and of Jewish pride. And that's the point of V'nahafochu. V'nahafochu is the day that you wanted to make the day of infamy, the day that everyone would mourn the Jews. For thousands of years, people would get together. Remember those Jews? Remember those people who lived and they no longer inhabit this earth? That day has become the greatest Yom Tov for Am Yisrael. V'nahafochu. And that's why, whether Mordechai and Esther sensed that, or Hashem gave them some instinct, that's why the same day. Could have been militarily more strategic to pick an earlier date. But the same day that you wanted to slate for Jewish genocide became our Purim. We're celebrating the day that you earmarked on the calendar to eliminate the Jewish people. And that's why so many of the stories in Megillas Esther are palindromes, where the exact same thing that Haman wanted to do to us fell back on him. Why do we need the story of the tree? I mentioned it yesterday. The story of the tree doesn't really propel the narrative. The narrative is propelled by the demise and the deposing of Haman. And Haman is killed. Why do we need the whole story? Where he makes the tree, and the tree is reported, and Zeresh encourages him for the tree, and he visits Achashverosh about the tree. Because in the end, the gallows that he had designed for Mordechai become his own gallows. So this is not, I want you to listen carefully, this is not Mida Kineged Mida. Mida Kineged Mida means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes, and the punishment is proportionate. And there's an ironic twist, it's poetic justice. So the Egyptians wanted to drown us in the Nile, so they were drowned in the Yam Suf. But it's not like when they were drowning us in the Nile, they themselves got drowned in the Nile. It's not like the buildings that they made us build crumbled on them. That's not Mida Kineged Mida. That is the engine that you generate to destroy the Jewish people becomes the engine of Jewish growth and of Jewish pride. So Haman believes, in his mind, he's spinning visions that he's going to be the person on the horse. And who's the person on the horse? Mordechai. That's why the horse story is so important. Zeresh on day one, after the first party, says, you got them, go hang Mordechai. And the same Zeresh on day two says, by the way, you're a dead man. Nefolti pal lefanav. The exact same letter writing apparatus is described in Perek Gimel, the letters of genocide, and in Perek Zion, the letters of Jewish salvation, of Jewish Perek Ches, of restoring the Jewish people. Everything that happens in the Megillah is V'nahafochu, and that's not Mida Kineged Mida. It's the first time you're seeing this in Jewish history, but it represents a whole new pattern, that the irony is not just that Hashem prevents us from annihilation, but the apparatus that was set up to destroy us becomes the apparatus to fuel Jewish growth. And I just want to give you a couple examples. Again, these are very, very hard examples to give because they all concern Jewish tragedies. And when Jewish tragedy occurs, we mourn the tragedy. When we say, oh, but look at the silver lining. Look at what it did create. So we don't know why these tragedies occurred, and we hope that they would never occur again. But you're able to see, and to a degree, it started even before Purim. Kasher ya'anu oso, ken yirbeh v'chein yifrotz in Parsha Shmos. The more that power persecuted us, but we don't see that the persecutional tools created the growth. There's actually a very interesting pasuk in Yechezkel where the Jews are compared to grass. We talk about it on the night of Pesach. It's a trick question. How many metaphors are there for Jewish destiny? You'd say three. Sand, dust, and stars. Those are the metaphors of Bereishis we spoke about yesterday. Sand and dust are different. But if you look in Yechezkel, we're called Revava Kitzemach Hasad Nesaticha. I've placed you like the blades of grass. It's in Yechezkel Perek Tazayin. Why are we compared to grass? A lot of answers to that question, but the Ritva says in his parish on the Haggadah, the reason we're compared to grass is, anyone knows, I used to be a gardener. Fortunately, I'm no longer a gardener. When you cut your grass, it grows more. So once you cut it, the more it grows. And once you shave, the more your beard will grow in. So, listening to this up. So, if you cut the grass, it's going to grow more. See, Morty's trying to get there. If you cut the grass, it will grow more. So the same thing with Am Yisrael. Where do we see this in history? Again, these are very hard profiles to provide, but we certainly see it in Nazi Germany, Yimach Shemam, where in their minds, the 1940s would be the worst decade in Jewish history, and the 1940s would lead to the annihilation of the Jews. And 3 years afterwards, and in some ways because of it, and without getting into the geopolitics of it, what aspects of the Holocaust enabled, and without creating any moral equivalency, no one says that the state of Israel is compensation for the Holocaust, you can't compensate the Holocaust, but just from a purely historical, amoral standpoint, without bringing moral values into it, it's hard to imagine the arc of us returning to Eretz Yisrael without figuring in the Holocaust at the beginning of that decade. We're seeing it now to a degree where the constant attacks of our Arab enemies, had they just allowed us to settle peacefully and in prosperity as good neighbors, we wouldn't be here right now. We wouldn't be here in Gush Etzion. We wouldn't be at the Kotel. The original land of 1948 didn't include major swaths of Jewish homeland. We're not colonists. We defended ourselves. It just so happened we defended ourselves with Hashem's help, and land ended up in being restored to the rightful owners. But it's not like we're a conquest-driven culture. Let's go and conquer. Let's go and attack. There's never been any case where we've attacked any of our enemies, including 67. Even though we launched the first strike, they were basically assembling to annihilate us. So we're not a conquering people. We're not an aggressive, militant people. And you also think about some other points in history. I was thinking to myself last night, the 19th century was a horrible, horrible century for Russian Jewry. Horrible. If any of you come from Russian stock, as many Ashkenazim do, the laws, the legislation, the discrimination, I talked to you earlier this year about the Cantonist laws, where little Jewish boys were taken to the Russian army in mass for 25 years. You'd be lucky if you return home alive, let alone Jewish, being 25 years in the Russian army, fighting in some southern Asian country for 20 years. It's just the laws, the discrimination, the hatred, the quotas where you could live, the poverty. And that led to mass Russian emigration. And mass Russian emigration had two effects in Jewish history. Number one is probably about 2.5-3 million Russian Jews by and large migrated to the United States of America. And had those Jews not left Russia in the 19th century, then the numbers of 1940 and 1942 and at the Holocaust wouldn't have been 6 million. We would have been closer to 8 million and 9 million, because most of the Russian Jews, some of the Jews in Central Europe, were able to escape. Russian Jews didn't escape. Russian Jews was Einsatzgruppen. Russian Jews were right in Auschwitz. If you're a Russian Jew, your chance of escape, you could move Easter in Russia, but then you hit the communists. It wasn't easy for Russian Jews in World War II to escape the Holocaust. Most of the escape stories are German Jews that had passports, Hungarian Jews, Western European Jews, French Jews who were hidden. And second of all, and we're seeing now, most of the Russian Jewish emigration established America as a very heavy Jewish community with a lot of Jewish influence and a lot of Jewish political activism. Remember, how many Jews were there during the War of Independence? Maybe 2,500, maybe 2,000. By 1830, 1840, you're talking about maybe a couple tens of thousands, 40,000. And all of a sudden, you have this mass migration of Russian Jews, most of them to the United States of America. Changes the complexion of American Jewry, which by extension ripples and changes the complexion of world Jewry. So the Russians, Yimach Shemam, of the 19th century, the Tsarist regime, who if not for Hitler would have been known as the worst anti-Semitic regime in the last 300 years, I'm thinking a little bit about the Spanish Inquisition and how the dispersal of Spanish Jewry across the Arabian world created the Sephardic culture. Remember, to being a Sephardi means you're a Spanish person. What does it mean? I live in Iraq. There were local Iraqi customs. Local Iraqi Jews had their own customs. Local Egyptian Jews had their customs. When the Spaniards came to town, they were rich, they were smart, they were educated, they were big Talmidei Chachamim. The local Arab Jews didn't stand the chance. They became Sephardicized, and it created the whole world of Sephard. So it's hard to talk about these tragedies as if they spurred Jewish growth and to sanitize them, because there's a lot of suffering and a lot of loss and a lot of... But Hashem created a pattern in Megillas Esther that would recycle itself throughout history. That not only were the anti-Semites be defeated, and not only were the anti-Semites be defeated proportionately with some ironic twist that we call the Mida Keneged Mida, but that the apparatus that was assembled to destroy the Jewish people would be the engine that would drive Jewish growth. And the Jewish growth that's driven in the end of Megillas Esther is, of course, the Beis HaMikdash. Mordechai becomes the head of the household of Haman. Could you imagine if you didn't just defeat Hitler, but you were given all of Hitler's assets? And according to Chazal, Rashi quotes, he actually became the head of his household, like with extra children. Haman had children who evidently weren't killed. There were 10 who were killed, 10 who were hung. He's not sure whether the same who were killed were hung. Maybe it's 20. Haman had a lot of children, Verov Banav. And Mordechai becomes head of that household. And at some point, all that wealth was returned to Eretz Yisrael. So ironically, all the wealth that Haman assembled becomes the money that builds the Beis HaMikdash. All the money he saved, because Achashverosh was so genocidal, and those 10,000 shekelim weren't handed to Achashverosh, they become Mordechai's assets, and then they return to Eretz Yisrael, and the Beis HaMikdash is built. So all of these designs that Haman had to annihilate the Jewish people ends up a few years later in Yerushalayim, with the Jews being saved, and the Beis HaMikdash being built on the same day he wanted to annihilate us, with the same horse and with the same tree. And that's why Venhafahu is such a powerful. Venhafahu doesn't mean inversion. It means boomerang. It means you wanted to employ a tool of genocide, it becomes a tool of Jewish growth, and sometimes, unfortunately, in history, a little bit of both. A tool of Jewish suffering, but a tool of Jewish growth. And we'll end the series of Shiurim. We don't know where this is landing. We know where it's landing. We don't know how it's going to land and in what shape. But we know one thing, that whatever happened on October 7th, one day we'll realize has become a tool for Jewish growth, has become a tool for Jewish expansion, has become a tool for pushing ahead the arc of Jewish history. We don't know how, but that's what we should think about on Purim. That somehow we'll look back at October 7th and not sanitize, God forbid, the loss and the tragedy, but realize v'nafachu. The day that they wanted to create as a day of infamy for the Jewish people, somehow, in some historical calculus, became an engine for Jewish growth. Okay, have a great Shabbos, everyone. Anyone here in the choir? No choir people? Okay, see you tonight anyway.
Thank you so much.